Welcome to Oncology Today. Updates from the ASH 2022 meeting on lymphomas. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Matthew Lunning from the Fred and Pamela Buffett Cancer Center at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. To begin, Dr. Lunning commented on a follow-up presentation of the POLARIX study looking at first-line therapy of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which included the antibody-drug conjugate polatuzumab vedotin.
I think one of the studies that still remains top of mind to many of us who see frontline diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients is, where in the world is the POLARIX data and where is it going? And, you know, are there technologies that are going to continue to drive, you know, not only the relapse refractory setting, but now being employed in the frontline setting? And that really comes around circulating tumor DNA. And where's the application in that in some of our more common diseases? We've seen this in, you know, other more accessible disease landscapes, potentially around, you know, the concept of minimal residual disease and, you know, different technologies. And it just, to me, seems like we keep moving the football, you know, field goal post a little bit further away from, you know, using this technology to help risk adapt or risk stratify therapies or a number of cycles. And so, you know, let's just refresh on what the POLARIX study was. So this was a double-blind, randomized, ginormous frontline study in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Patients had to have an IPI score of 2 to 5 in order to enter into the study. This was agnostic to a cell of origin, whether or not that was done by, you know, your gene expression profiling or immunohistochemistry for activated B-cell or germinal center B-cell subtypes. Again, it did, you know, allow double expressors, your non-double expressing type of lymphomas. The control arm was, you know, standard R-CHOP, and the experimental arm was polatuzumab, rituximab, CHIP, and so removing the vincristine arm. And we know kind of from the initial POLARIX data and from the publication that there was, and this did meet the primary endpoint, expanding that progression-free survival, event-free survival curves. Here in this abstract that was presented at ASH by Dr. Herrera, they really dug down to those patients that they had matched tumor DNA, not only at the time before starting therapy, but then reassessed it at cycle 2, day 1. And they looked in the POLARCHIP arm and they said, okay, you know, those patients who have a log-fold change that was greater than 2.5. So again, so this is logarithmic, you know, looking at the amount of circulating tumor DNA, and then over time, in a very short period of time, is that predictive of those patients who were going to have better outcomes if you look at it from a progression-free survival standpoint? And you can see on the left here that when you look at several disease characteristics, all of them in this forest plot portended to be in favor of those individuals who had a log-fold change of greater than 2.5 in regards, and so regardless of their disease characteristics. And then jumping over to the right, looking at the progression-free survival. So if you had a log-fold change of greater than 2.5, your two-year estimated PFS was 87%, versus if you did not, your two-year PFS was 66%. And so, again, this kind of looks at the flavors of, you know, we're really trying to move not only radiographically, if you think about, you know, studies like ZUMA 12, you know, which informed kind of after two cycles of anthracycline-based therapy, you know, could you enrich for a population who needed cellular therapy at that time point? But here is kind of looking at only after one cycle, could you dichotomize a patient population that may need something better? What that better is, I think, is still out there. But, you know, at least it's moving the needle to the point where we could maybe say, OK, this may be a technology that we can employ in the frontline setting to kind of think about what to do next or how do we continue to, you know, advance outcomes in frontline large cell lymphoma.
So I'm curious what your perspective is clinically on the Polarix trial. Would you like to use this strategy? And if so, in which patients? Have you been able to do it with it not being approved? Any thoughts?
You know, I haven't dipped my toe in the water yet of using polatuzumab, R-CHIP in the frontline setting. I still do look for the double hit biology based upon FISH. So I still am using R-CHOP or dose-adjusted EPOCH-R. I think that I will be likely an early adopter if it does gain FDA approval from that standpoint, because I do believe that polatuzumab, is a better agent than vincristine. I can't think of the last time I thought about a refractory patient giving vincristine single agent in the relapse refractory setting, but I have absolutely no problem giving polatuzumab, as a bridge to CAR T cell if a patient has relapsed or refractory large cell lymphoma.
Do you see any downside other than economic to using a Polarix strategy?
I really don't. I think if you look into this study and knowing that it's a double blind, trial, from an investigator standpoint, you really couldn't tell who is on which arm, right? If you look just purely at peripheral neuropathy, which was, I think, the biggest driver. And if you think about your analogies to brentuximab vedotin, as using a very similar, warhead in MMAE, I typically don't see the peripheral neuropathy when I use brentuximab vedotin until I start to approach the double-digit number of cycles. So if you're using, I know I'm jumping diseases, but if I was using an Athera approach in Hodgkin's lymphoma, I start to see the neuropathy as I get to 9, 10, 11, not 1 through 6.
If it does become accessible and approved, what about using it based on a genomic subset? There are some people who are hesitant. Other people say, it wasn't a planned analysis, not enough patients. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think that the data continues to state that it appears to be somewhat agnostic to subtype of interest. And I don't think that, we all have the 99% have IHC, the 1% have gene expression profiling. So I think gene expression profiling by IHC is probably going out the window. As well as IHC, I think we're doing it, and some people are doing it to dichotomize more so enriching for those who you should do FISH on, using that plus c-myc expression to state, where are our double hits. I think the data is still not convincing enough to me to abandon dose-adjusted EPOCH-R in my double hit that I knowingly have. But I may commonly give a cycle of anthracycline-based therapies like R-CHOP and then divert to dose-adjusted EPOCH-R if I see a double hit biology in patients that I need to treat right away.
So I think the original, hazard rate, the forest plot, it did look, even though there weren't that many patients, like there was a difference based on ABC or non-GCB subtype.
Yeah.
That was kind of what I was referring to.
Yeah, I caution that if my recollection serves me right, I think there was a lot of missing data in the in that forest plot, almost more than, either one of the other arms. And so, it's kind of a wash to me, in that regard. And I'm not sure that polatuzumab over time has shown as a single agent that it really cared, what it looked like from an ABC versus GCB standpoint. All I know is that it was a positive study. And, what message does it send to, future clinical trials if a study that meets its primary endpoint in a randomized double-blind study doesn't at least get an opportunity to advance the field?
You were making the analogy to the Echelon 1 study, which I think really is a great analogy. And one of the things that we saw there was early on, I never was like totally clear about why people kind of thought more about it in high risk. And then once the survival data came out, everybody looked at it differently. I have heard people talk about Polarix in that point of view, in terms of, more for higher risk where, the benefit, obviously the absolute benefit would be, somewhat greater. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think R-CHOP always performs better in a clinical trial than it probably does in the real world. I mean, we've seen that in numerous, I can't too many to count clinical trials that have come up against our CHOP and failed, right? So why are we, you know, holding this trial not in a different esteem? It beat our CHOP. You know, everybody, you know, goes and talks about our ACVP, you know, and it beat our CHOP in a European study. But our ACVP is really two different trial regimens and much more intense than, you know, Pola-R-CHIP. And this is, you know, this is mano a mano. You know, this is one drug, you know, blinded, couldn't tell. Yes, I understand the economic ramifications are what they are. But at the end of the day, the best chance to cure R-CHOP is at the first is with the first treatment. And I just don't think that vincristine is in the same weight class as polatuzumab.
Please continue.
So kind of dovetailing very nicely, we talked a little bit about in the first abstract around circulating tumor DNA. This abstract looking at metabolic tumor volume and how it could predict in the relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, how well those patients do with a different therapy, a therapy that's approved in the relapse refractory setting, loncastuximab tesirine. And so this is looking at some of the digging a little bit deeper into the radiographic measures of the LOTIS-2 trial. Again, loncastuximab tesirine, this is a CD19 antibody drug conjugate. What I find interesting about this drug is it brought into the therapeutic landscape a new warhead, which is the pyrrolobenzodiazepine warhead or a PDB dimer. And so this comes, you know, this isn't MMAE, this isn't MMAAF, you know, that we're accustomed to. So, you know, this drug did take some time to, you know, get a learning curve on what this warhead brings to the table from an AE profile. But once they found out kind of the dosing strategy, the drug did drive benefit. And so here it's really trying to go beyond SUV max. And we're going to see this in a couple of other abstracts and really drilling down into this metabolic tumor volume. And so, you know, as well as tumor lymphoma glycolysis, which is a uses metabolic tumor volume in a perhaps a little bit more detail. You know, one of my fears is that, yes, metabolic tumor volume does and appears, at least in this study, to do better than the maximum SUV, as did TLG. But, you know, one of the things that hasn't bore out in any of these abstracts is really diving into the time a nuclear medicine radiologist has to spend in order to get MTV or TLG, right? If you think about practically, right, outside of a research environment, how long does it take to read a Deauville score versus how much time does it take to get MTV or TLG? And you can use all the artificial intelligence you want. But in talking with my nuclear medicine radiologist, there is significant amount of contouring or, you know, second checking on the AI software. If anything, I know it's going to get better. But is MTV ready for prime time? I think it's intriguing, but I also think we have to keep in mind the practicality of that transition to moving beyond Deauville scores. You know, I know we've seen and that we didn't see here of Delta SUVs, you know, being talked about. So something to, you know, tickle the neurons a little bit. But I don't think MTV is going to, you know, outside of exploratory analyses like this, is going to is ready for prime time.
That's a really interesting point. Can you elaborate a little bit more about what you were saying about the warhead and particularly the AEs that are seen and your own experience with the AEs?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that the AEs of interest really have come around edema. And so, you know, whether or not it's pulmonary, more effusions or lower extremity edema, you know, that can be mitigated with steroids as well as potentially diuretics. You know, this drug is very interesting. It's given on a Q 3-week basis. Where you use kind of a higher dose for the first two doses, and then you cut the dose in half for subsequent doses. In my practice, when I use this, I'm checking for response after the first two doses because, you know, inherently I'm going down on the dose. And so if patients are stable disease or, you know, I have a little bit of hesitation that they're going to drive benefits in a long-term fashion, because really I'm using long-cast tuximab, you know, potentially after CAR T-cell failures, or I'm using it as a bridge to an allo transplant if I can get one of those patients that go into a, you know, a CR, or also to steal something from myeloma, a very good PR that I can kind of twist the arms of the allotransplant doctor to consider taking that patient, you know, to an allotransplant therapy.
Curious about your anecdotal experience in terms of efficacy. Have you personally seen patients with CRs, with prolonged responses, any sort of global feel for efficacy?
Yeah, I think it's really where we position this drugs, clinical trials, get us the ability to use drugs, and then, you know, approvals get us to really experience what it is like to really use the drugs. And I think we've seen some data to that effect. And that's unfortunate, you know, but that's just reality. I have seen patients derive benefit from the drug in the post-CAR T-cell setting. Has it been, you know, in my experience, miraculous CRs? Not necessarily, but disease stability that may, you know, get them the time that the bone marrow needs to recover after CAR T cells, such that, you know, at the time of progression, they can, you know, go to a clinical trial. Because I think that's one of the things that is really hampering relapse refractory large cell lymphoma right now in the post-CAR T cell relapse setting, is the cytopenias that preclude patients from going on to clinical trials. So you have to use therapies like tafalen or long-cast tuximab, or, you know, very rarely checkpoint inhibitors. You know, we're in the off-label land here, you know, when I talk about that. But it is really kind of trying to stabilize the disease to get to a, you know, to get to a trial or get to another therapy. When your platelets are 69 instead of 75, you know, or your ANC is 900 instead of 1,000. Sad, but yeah, but true.
What about in patients who aren't going to be considered for CAR T? Any experience there with, you know, there's a bunch of options. People have a lot of questions about what comes first and all. But again, what have you observed? How much of a problem are these effusions in edema? And again, in the non-post-CAR T, do you also see similar kinds of benefit or different?
Yeah, I think that the first part is getting experience with the drug and then getting experience and actually looking for it, right? You got to know about it before you're going in the room, right? You know, how do you catch a pleural effusion? Well, you actually have to listen to the lungs, right? You know, there should be dullness at the bases. You have to ask the right questions of, are you feeling like you're having more dyspnea on exertion? You know, can you walk less of a distance? You're not necessarily, I'm not doing chest x-rays every cycle, you know, but I am examining the pretibial area bilaterally and asking them certain respiratory, questions that give me a higher pretest probability that if I do the next test, I might find something.
Yeah, that's a really good clinical point. All right, let's continue. I guess another paper on metabolic tumor volume.
Yes. Yeah, so this is, thematically here, tried to go in some semblance of an order here, but we're kind of jumping now from our antibody drug conjugates to cellular therapy. And this is looking at the ZUMA-7 trial. And so just to refresh everybody's memory, this is ZUMA-7. If it's a ZUMA trial, it's an AxiCell. At least ZUMA-7, ZUMA-1, ZUMA-12, or AxiCaptogene-Silalusil, or AxiCell. So this was its second-line study where it went head-to-head against standard of care. And that standard of care, you know, was your classical ARCH, our ICE, our GDP, our DHAP. In first relapse, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, those patients who are primary refractory or had relapsed within a year. So really trying to enrich for that poor, or where we know is poor outcomes based upon the Scholar 1 data. We know that ZUMA-7 met its primary endpoint for EFS. And so this is really starting to look at, can we dig a little bit deeper based upon radiographic measures into metabolic tumor volume that can dichotomize, you know, those patients who may or may not do well with cellular therapy. We know, at least from the data, that standard of care appeared to not do very well. And you can see it here in this event-free survival curve. The reason for this is, you know, when we look at some of the data in large cell lymphoma, we use SPD. And SPD has been trying to be a measure of, you know, how big or what's the volume, if you will, in a non-volumetric measure, because you're using area essentially as part of the equation, on how much does the CAR T cells have to chomp away to get to a CR. And maybe it's not telling all of the story, and maybe metabolic tumor volume can tell a better amount of the story, because you may have a higher SPD, but the MTV might be lower. And so this is just using MTV, I believe at a cutoff of 41% or greater was high, 41% or lower was low. And you can see here the low MTV group did better with axi-cel. But I think the real story here is the high MTV with axi-cel even did better than those patients who had a low MTV that got the standard of care arm. And remember, those patients were patients that went on to get second line chemotherapy with an intent to go to an autologous stem cell transplant if a chemosensitive response was amenable in the control arm. And so MTV may have a role here. But again, it's kind of what do you do with it? You know, what's the next step? You know, do you risk adapt those axi-cel high MTV patients to get something else beyond axi-cel, either as a precursor to CAR T-cell or as a maintenance therapy after CAR T-cell? And I finally think we're starting to get into that landscape in the clinical trials where we have enough, you know, data, we've enriched the population enough, because, you know, I think you and I can agree, Dr. Love, that there's still a significant amount of area above the curve in the event-free survival. We can try to do better to cure more patients, you know, in second-line large cell lymphoma, especially, you know, in this heavily chemo-refractory patient population that's just, you know, their disease laughed at our chop. And so sticking to the axi-cel theme here, this is an abstract that I got the pleasure to present at ASH this year. And what I thought was, you know, the data was pretty self-explanatory. I really enjoy the question and answer period of my oral presentation. Also, I think there were some provocative questions, one that gets at the real world and just real kind of societal issues around therapies globally. And this was really looking at those patients who were in Scholar 1 and then matching them to, you know, the axi-cel experience and trying to do a matched analysis and looking to see what was the true outcomes of age and other variables, whether or not you went to CAR T-cel or if you got chemoimmunotherapy. And you can look here, you know, one of the things that I've always been interested in is to look at age and CAR T-cell outcomes. And, you know, across the board, you know, pretty much age didn't matter, right? Sometimes the those who are 65 or older and got cellular therapy may appear to do, you know, it's a slightly better, but it's not, you know, often statistically different. But here you can see, regardless of age and with axi-cel, you know, you had a better chance of getting into a CR with a CAR T-cell therapy compared to chemo immunotherapy. And regardless of age, your probability of living longer was higher if you were shunted down that CAR T-cell journey versus if you just continued to get chemo immunotherapy. I think the biggest thing here is that age should not define CAR T-cell eligibility. We should be striking that from clinical trials. I don't see a reason why, if it becomes part of your national guidelines to say, you know, you are not CAR T-cell eligible if you are 65 or 70. I just don't think the data supports that. You know, granted, you have to look at other comorbid conditions, right? I mean, and I don't think that this applies just to axi-cel. I think this data set, you know, applies to axi-cel. But my gut is that this applies to the other CAR T-cells that are approved in large B-cell lymphoma and the relapse refractory setting. I think that this is just a perception that axi-cel perhaps is the toughest to get older individuals, you know, through. And, you know, I think that that has been my experience, but I don't think that it's impossible. And you have to use some clinical judgment on who's going to get axi-cel versus who's going to get lysi-cel versus who's going to get tisa-cel versus who's going to get a clinical trial, you know, with a cellular therapy agent. But one of the things that I don't think is age should be a definer. And I went as far as to say that it's potentially ageism at this point, based upon the data.
I guess the other question is going to be who's going to get a bispecific, but just sticking with CAR T, you mentioned comorbidities. Any specific comorbidities that relate to CAR T, a cardiac, renal function, any sort of red flags for you specifically in terms of types of comorbidities?
Yeah, I think the, you know, a data set that I'm not going to talk about, but I think that really tried to hammer, you know, into this in some chink in the armor to those who say, you know, too sick to CAR, was the pilot study. You know, the pilot study was looking at patients over the age of 70. They had compromised renal function. They had cardiac down to an EF of 40%. You know, they had DLCO parameters that, you know, who knows what those mean. And looking at those outcomes, you know, those patients were able, some of them were able to get outpatient CAR T cell, you know, and stay outpatient. You know, so I do analyze creatinine clearance because I do adjust the fludarabine dose around creatinine clearance. I think that that does play a part not only in cytopenias or prolonged cytopenias, but potentially the risk of fludarabine-induced neurotoxicity, which can cloud the picture when you're dealing with ICANS from that situation. I'm not sure that if you have well-compensated heart failure, you know, and it's well-managed, that that necessarily has to be in the equation. And remember, in the trials, it was oxygenation greater than 92% or greater got you onto the trial, not a DLCO of some value, you know, from that standpoint. And then one of the other pieces is I really look at KPS from, you know, what it's driven by their comorbidities. And I look at KPS that's driven by their lymphoma, right? I'm more likely to take a patient to CAR T cell because I know that there are patients, my patients that are alive because of cellular therapy that would not be alive without it. And most of those patients came in hot, right? They came in with their lymphoma, you know, trying to take their lives. And the one thing that salvaged them was cellular therapy. And if That's you really have that risk benefit discussion with the patient and their family, and they know what they're entering into, this isn't, you know, this is the real world. This is life or death for a lot of these patients and their families. And if they get it, you go.
That's a really good point. I guess the other thing is, you know, I think at this point, people are aware of the fact that the criteria for an autologous transplant and CAR T is really somewhat different.
I think so. And, you know, I try to educate on that against that philosophy of, you know, a transplant equals, you know, CAR T cell eligibility and vice versa. You know, CAR T cell, you go in with disease. Transplants, you don't, or you try to go in with minimal amounts of disease. I think we can start to see, you know, some data to support that maybe we should chomp away at the disease a little bit if we can. But remember, you can't have, you know, the saying I like to use is you're really changing your wavelength a little bit about you want disease stabilization without ECOG migration. You can get, you know, but you got to choose wisely on what therapies you're using to kind of debulk the disease or stabilize the disease as you try to get to CAR T cell. Because the odds are if you're using combination chemotherapy, you're getting stable disease or maybe a little bit of reduction, but you may be coming at a risk of toxicity that makes them CAR T cell ineligible based upon damage to the bone marrow, the body, the organs. So the next abstract is looking at from the Transform data set. And so this was a randomized phase 3 trial of lysocaptagene marilucel or lysocel versus standard of care. And one of the things that was different between the Transform trial versus Zuma 7 that I wanted to call out in this abstract is that in Zuma 7, those patients who progressed on the experimental arm came off and got commercial CAR-T or didn't get CAR-T or got an experimental CAR-T or got some other therapy versus in the Transform trial, if you progressed on the experiment or the control arm, you were allowed to cross over and get Lysocell on the clinical trial. And so while the, you know, the data set here continues to show that an advantage in the experimental arm, which was Lysocell over the standard of care arm, you know, with a very short EFS of 2.4 months, this is the first time that we've seen the crossover subgroup. So how did those patients do, you know, that crossed over, that had an event in the control arm and then went on to receive Lysocell, if you will, in the third line setting where Lysocell is approved also. Right. But again, you got to remember that Transform enriched for a chemo refractory population, you know, those who are primary refractory or relapsed within 1 year. And so you can still see here the median PFS is 5.9 months. That's not great. Right. I mean, that's right in line where we were with the Transcend data set. So, you know, if you want to have the best outcomes in a primary refractory population or an early relapse population, second line CAR T cell is where it's at. It's not waiting for, you know, a third line, waiting them to get to the third line because then they're going to, you know, still get to CAR T cell. I think, you know, that we're finding the sweet spot of cellular therapy here, at least in this enriched patient population. And so really it begs, you know, the referral is, you know, call at primary refractory, call at first relapse. Don't just give them second line chemoimmunotherapy. Let the CAR T cell center kind of help with the nuances of how to get there and how to get there in the second line. The next study is kind of a match-adjusted indirect comparison of Lysocell versus Axi-cel for second-line patients. And so this is trying to align, you know, taking the Transform data and the Zuma 7 data in the best statistically, you know, massaging way when you know that there is probably never going to be a second-line head-to-head trial of Axi-cel versus Lysocell in a similar patient population. How can you, in a statistical mindedness, analyze these two unique data sets? And you can see here, I think what I take away from this is, you know, Lysocell is probably equally effective to Axi-cel. You know, if you look at the toxicities, you know, just along the way, perhaps there's less CRS, there's less high-grade ICANS with Lysocell to Axi-cel. But this is, again, in the setting of not doing a lot of the risk mitigation strategies now that are being employed with Axi-cel. So, again, you're trying to compare apples to apples, but you're not, you know, flavoring the new things that we're doing for Axi-cel to reduce the risk of high-grade CRS or high-grade ICANS. In my practice, you know, I'm not trying to necessarily negate all CRS. I'm trying to negate all grade 3-4 CRS. I'm trying to negate all grade 3-4 ICANS. But, you know, my patients, we talk very candidly when I'm giving Axi-cel to expect a fever, to expect grade 1 CRS, to note that we may be using tocilizumab, you know, at the signs of first hypotension, to help kind of pull the reins back on that CAR T cell, because it's just feeding too fast. It's too much of a feeding frenzy, and we need to slow it down to try and prevent, you know, high-grade CRS and high-grade neurotoxicity. You just may need to do that less with Lysocell in my experience.
So I'm just kind of curious, putting aside reimbursement and just in terms of your own belief, what you think you'd like to do, what are the situations right now where you think it's really in the patient's best interest to with relapse, diffuse large B cell, to get autologous transplant first before CAR T? And what happens when you use autologous transplant after CAR-T?
Yeah, I haven't been in the situation. I'll answer the second part first. I haven't been in the situation yet where I've taken a post-CAR-T cell patient to an auto transplant. In my mind, the die's been cast at that point. And those patients, I'm moving them towards an allo transplant because I just, you know, they're often chemo refractory. I'm not sure that a beam-based, high-dose therapy is going to be curative intent. And I think that when you're having CAR T cell, that's curative intent, in my opinion, and so I'm still, if I'm moving in that pathway, I'm still looking for other curative intent, paths for that patient. And we're having that discussion around the question of when do you do an auto transplant still, I still think that if you relapsed at 18 months after frontline chemotherapy, our ICE and for 2 to 3 cycles response evaluation, and if you're in a metabolic CR or even a very good PR, and I know that's not terminology that's accustomed in DLBCL clinical trials, but I think it exists, these very good partial remissions. I think you can still take those people to an auto transplant and you can look the patient straight in the eye and still say, I think that we're doing this with curative intent. Do we have other options am I going to be looking at day 60 or day 100 for early relapses in that patient population? Absolutely. Because the second that patient relapses after an auto transplant, every day matters, right? You just may be catching their disease at a lower disease burden that may afford them a better opportunity with cellular therapy to get a durable remission and potentially another opportunity at cure.
All right, please continue.
So now we're going to segue from cellular therapies to talking about, which kind of was top of mind, I think, at ASH this year was, really the discussion around, and I'll speak to a little bit about this in the follicular lymphoma section too, about how are we going to insert bispecifics into the equation of cure, not only for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but one could argue potentially follicular lymphoma. I know that we don't often use the C word in follicular lymphoma, but I think we're venturing into this non-chemoimmunotherapy, looking at some pretty good outcomes and some pretty good durability here. But glofitamab is a CD3, CD20 bispecific or T-cell engager. And so I always, like to think about this is that, remember, these patients have seen a lot of rituximab, right? So their CD20 has been perturbed a lot. And now we're going and asking really what is a matchmaker drug, right? It's trying to match a B cell that still expresses enough CD20 and to engage a CD3 T cell that's also been a little bit beat up by prior chemotherapy. Introducing those two components via this drug and asking those T cells to kill those B cells through, many likely different mechanisms, some we understand and probably many we don't. And so one of the things with glofitamab is that it comes with a partner, comes with obinutuzumab kind of as a lead-in. There is then with almost all of our bispecifics thus far, a step-up dosing strategy. Glofitamab is a fixed duration therapy or being developed as a fixed duration therapy, which is what this is looking at. So at the end of treatment, which is about 6 months of therapy, those individuals in this trial, so 61 that entered at that end of treatment evaluation in a complete remission, how did those patients do when they came off therapy and what is the percentage? And you'll see some drop off here, some of it because patients hadn't reached that time point yet. But really, you can see the opportunity for disease control over time. The green bars, obviously go down over time. But I think the question truly is going to be is can you come off therapy and relapse refractory large cell lymphoma? And then if you do have a relapse, can you reuse, this class of drugs to reengage the immune system after giving it a break and still get the same, ability to get a complete remission? And what do you do? In that situation, I think is the question. It's not been quite answered here. This is in the face of the other bispecific that's kind of trucking along here, which is epcoritamab, which is a continuous, use in the relapse refractory large B cell landscape. I'm not going to talk about any of the epco data here today, but I really do think that there are two camps here. There's the camp that you continue, and then the camp that you put it back on the shelf and wait for another day, and you see what kind of benefit you get. And I think that in large cell lymphoma, you know, it's a precarious place right now, because, you know, getting a CR in the relapse refractory large cell lymphoma, you know, arena usually occurs with a blink of an eye, right? It's usually a window opportunity to do something else, in my opinion. So if I get a CR in large cell lymphoma, you know, I may want to continue, you know, therapy, because you don't know if you stop, if you're ever going to see that CR again. But bispecifics and some of this data of duration of response, and if you can get, you know, a CR and then off therapy for, let's say, 2 years, and then it relapses and you can go into a CR again, patients may like that, even though the disease carries with it, you know, classically, not a very good prognosis. This is looking at this trial is looking at mosunetuzumab monotherapy in patients who are elderly or unfit and previously untreated diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. You know, I think that what I take away from this study is mosunetuzumab, again, is a CD3, CD19 bispecific. This one doesn't come with a obinutuzumab lead-in, but it does have a step-up dosing. I always caution, you know, these elderly unfit trials in DLBCL, because, you know, it's very hard for me to find an age, you know, where I know I can't give or at least start or try full dose R-CHOP. And what always is curious to me is to see who gets frontline therapy, doesn't have a response, or with these primary progressors, and then to see what their next line of therapy is, right? And so, you know, we've seen some trials in other diseases where you get a novel frontline therapy that's not chemotherapy based, and then with the second line treatment they get anthracycline based chemotherapy. So it's kind of like, well, what made them fit now to get to R-CHOP as a second line? So I think some of this is always in the details. There are, you know, the opportunity to put patients, you know, into a complete remission here. You can see it. There are patients who are in relapse. So I think that this is interesting. The CR rate is 43%. The 12-month PFS was 39% in this trial. So further data needed. I'm not sure that mosunetuzumab is the strongest bispecific in the large cell space. And so we're just going to have to see where this is going to go. Now, switching from our aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphomas and jumping to our most common indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, that would be speaking to follicular lymphoma. And the first abstract that I chose to talk about comes from Dr. Leonard and the AUGMENT trial. For those of you who don't remember the AUGMENT trial, this was really looking at patients with relapse refractory indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Both follicular and marginal zone were included in this data set. But it really looked at a rituximab-sensitive group that needed therapy. There was some low-burden patients, but in the eyes of the trial, required therapy that either got lenalidomide, rituximab, or your R-squared regimen versus rituximab plus placebo. And I think this is showing a 5-year results, and looking at the overall survival, that the curves continue to plateau in the R-squared arm. And in my opinion, with this trial, R-squared remains the backbone in second line treatment of relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. I think you're seeing that in the subsequent Me Too trials, which is R-squared plus something versus R-square in itself and relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. I just really wish, as a field, when we are doing clinical trials in indolent lymphomas, we ask why the patient need or why the investigator thinks that this patient needs treatment for their follicular lymphoma. Because far too often we get muddy results when we're looking at the those tables, kind of going like, is this really a population that needed treatment for their follicular lymphoma or not? And I wish we could put a bigger magnifying glass, you know, when we get to clinical trials and looking at really was this a population that could have waited a little bit longer for their treatment versus needed to go on a clinical trial. The next study, kind of leaning into this, Me Too clinical trial landscape, this is in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, is taking the EZH2 oral therapy tazemetostat. We know tazemetostat has activity in both EZH2 mutant and EZH2 wild type, and I think that things are getting a little bit grayer on whether or not we're should be testing for EZH2 mutational status before using this drug. I think I still do a little bit to help kind of entertain my expectations around responses, response rates, but it appeared, at least in the data, that the durability of response appeared to be fairly equivalent, just maybe a lower response rate in those wild type groups. But this is looking at kind of all comers and taking that tazemetostat and adding it to lenalidomide and rituximab. Really, I think tazemetostat was a very attractive partner to R squared because of the adverse event profile of tazemetostat. It looked to be very well tolerated in the patient populations that was studied. How well tolerated that will be in the real world, I think, is worth waiting to see if data sets looking at that come out. 88% of the population in this 44 patients that were enrolled in the SYMPHONY-1 trial were EZH2 wild type. There were no DLTs seen in this lead-in. A 98% overall response rate with 51% complete remissions. The median PFS was not reached. Median overall survival was not reached. And the big thing here is there's no safety signals seen at the 800 BID dose with standard R squared. So I think that this is you're looking at the curves, this is an appropriate partner to move into a larger phase 3, which is currently accruing. The next is looking at jumping back into cellular therapy land, Zuma 5, which is looking at the 3-year follow-up of axi-cel, and this is in patients with relapsed refractory indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So again, the largest number of patients was in follicular lymphoma, a smaller number of marginal zone lymphoma patients, but really seeing here, everybody's kind of waiting for, is there going to be a plateau on that curve? And is that plateau high enough that I would, use cellular therapy in follicular lymphoma? If you look at the 36-month kind of landmark for lymphoma-specific survival, it was at 75%. One of the things that concerned me, this is where you just got to take the investigators, feedback to heart, is, was the marginal zone lymphoma cohort early on looked a little bit precarious. But now, it appears that those curves have, stabilized out a little bit to be more representative of the follicular lymphoma cohorts, because people were wondering, like, what is it about marginal zone lymphoma that, people weren't doing as well? Maybe that's not so. The other thing that I look at in these indolent lymphoma therapies with cellular therapy is what's the kind of the outcome after people relapse. And, that's, these signs of transformative relapses. So I worry sometimes that, if you use cellular therapy early, what do you do if a patient transforms? And I'm not seeing that here, that the escape mechanism per se, based upon the data that I've seen, is stating that, these people that are progressing with marginal zone or follicular lymphoma are escaping as large cell lymphoma. And, that's a prognosis changer if that occurs. All right. So this is also looking at a different CAR T cell that's approved in the relapse refractory setting. And that's Tisagen Lucel. And this is data from the ALARA trial. So again, kind of looking at a similar longer term data. This analysis is at 24 months, showing 57%, the possibility of being event free. If you had to ask me to go to a wall blindly and draw a duration of response curves to cellular therapy, this would be the curve that you could draw, in the dark, which is, if you can get into an early CR, that's where the opportunity for durability is, not only in large cell lymphoma, but what it appears to be in indolent lymphomas and in mantle cell lymphoma. So the time point just may change a little bit. So in early large cell lymphoma, in my experience, it's an early CR at 3 months. And then if you have stability at 6 months, you know, those are the patients who are likely to derive long-term benefit. In our indolent lymphomas, I think the lesson here is maybe that inflection point's a little bit later at 6 months. And between that 3 to 6 months, you can still capture some of those PRs to go to CRs. But you just got to be a little bit more patient in marginal zone and follicular to see those CRs mature. And so I'm not panicking as much as I probably do in the large cell lymphoma when I'm not seeing a CR at 3 months in my follicular lymphoma patient population that I'm, you know, if I were to take a patient to the to CAR T cell in that disease. But I think the real question is, you know, where do we slot bispecifics in a relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma? And this is data from mosunetuzumab. This is being used as a monotherapy. And this is a very interesting analysis. So you have a, you know, a trial that just gave mosunetuzumab single agent, but then they, you know, went into their own patient population and said, well, how do these people do, you know, with the therapy that was right before, you know, they got mosunetuzumab? And you can see here, that's the green line. So that's how, what the PFS was to the therapy that predated that, and then marched out the curves of what mosunetuzumab did from a PFS standpoint. So I really think that this gave the opportunity to kind of say, you know, mosun at least shouldn't be inserted here, but it probably, you know, should be inserted a little bit earlier. And these were patients who had received two or prior greater prior lines of therapy. And again, just like glofitamab, mosunetuzumab is a time-limited therapy. So I think in my practice, as soon as we, you know, get, you know, we have experience using bispecifics, but I am going to be talking to patients about bispecifics, you know, likely as third line in follicular lymphoma. And I think it will move CAR T cell to the later lines or, you know, when that transformative biology comes, if it does come. And then, you know, I threw this in here just because, you know, I wanted to see, you know, we know about blinatumomab, and blinatumomab had a little bit of a history in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But this is kind of coming at a different bispecific, which is looking at a CD3, CD19. Again, mosun and glofit and epco and odronextamab, you know, those are CD3, CD20. This is really bringing back, you know, CD19, CD3 T-cell engagers in B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And how is it doing that? It's because it's an IV therapy that's given every 2 weeks. You can see the patient population here is very broad. And yes, it's small numbers, but look at that, median prior treatments, 4. I've never seen a range of 21 being the upper bounds, you know, in a relapse refractory trial. I'm not sure I can even name 21 trial or 21 therapies without recycling a few. But anyways, it is what it is. But look at over here, you know, those red boxes, usually red is not good. In this situation, red really calls it out as a CR, as a, in a box. So that's not progression, folks. That's CRs. So this is a very interesting, drug to watch here. You know, got an overall response rate of 72% with a CR of 61%. You know, so there, while it is entering a crowded space and needs longer follow-up, I'm very intrigued by TNB486.
So typical tolerability issues, CRS mainly?
Yes, and the CRS was seen with this drug. But remember, CRS, I'm not sure the pathophysiology and the pathobiology of CRS is the same in our bispecifics or our T-cell engagers as it is for CAR T-cell. And I think, you know, the boogeyman with regards to CRS and ICANS is, you know, maybe not as scary, if you will. You have to have the right setup and you have to, you know, not forget about it. But, you know, I think we're getting more accustomed to realizing CRS is just the, you know, the way of the therapy. You know, it's kind of like if you were, I wasn't practicing when rituximab first hit the market, you know, and infusion related reactions were occurring, you know, and we just learned how to manage them, right? It became a physician, you know, IRR. And then really it was in the hands of, you know, right now it's in the hands of our oncology nurses, You know, we built plans out on how to risk mitigate, and as well as how to treat. We will get there with bispecifics to where bispecifics and CRS and ICANS is not necessarily an impediment to the therapy, but it is just an acknowledgement that that can come. And we just will have systems in place and guidelines in place to bring these therapies to the patients.
I don't know if you know, but I was kind of wondering what I would think a lot of general medical oncologists would not typically have tocilizumab available in their clinic. I guess they would probably need to. And is it any big deal to have it, to use it clinically?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure that the jury's out on T-cell engagers and the immediate necessity of tocilizumab. I think we really need to look at this as a field. You know, this is kind of one of those situations where the field may have gotten ahead of the data. I'm not sure that steroids is not going to be as effective or more effective for CRS management than tocilizumab. You know, granted, we're going to have to look at the data. We're going to have to look at, to your point about having tocilizumab on hand. And the cart may have gotten a little bit ahead of the horse here, in regards to risk mitigation, CRS management. But, 10 milligrams of dexamethasone is a heck of a lot cheaper and a heck of a lot more accessible than tocilizumab. And I'm not, it comes back to the whole principle of, we are the ones who chose to call this CRS, right? We, as the field. And I'm not sure necessarily that it's one in the same, and it needs to be managed one in the same. But we have to come together as a community to analyze the situation, because you're right. If you're going to use this in I'll just pick a town in Nebraska. If you're going to use this in Grand Island, Nebraska, I don't know if Grand Island, Nebraska, which has two hospitals and in a community practice, is going to have tocilizumab. Do you have it at the treatment site? Do you have it at the hospital? Do you have it at the ER? Do they have it at both hospitals? So there are truly some barriers that need to be overcome. But I'm just not convinced that 10 milligrams of dexamethasone isn't as good in CRS management as a dose of tocilizumab. But I think that's for further discussion.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised in the same vein, when teclistamab, the bispecific in myeloma, was approved and they required hospitalization. I was like, is it really that bad? They have to be hospitalized for 9 days or something? Is that any thoughts about, I don't know if you have any exposure to that. Maybe, I'm sure you see the transplant patients.
Yeah, I think it is kind of the baggage that a class can carry over to another class, right?
Right.
And how do you, get drugs approved? Well, you decrease risk, right? And then when you try to bring it to the masses, you have to reassess risk, right? So a lot of these other bispecific therapies, at the beginning may have required hospitalization, but over time, did the label come out requiring hospitalization? Well, to my knowledge, mosunetuzumab didn't.
Right.
And so you let the data drive, the decision rather than, somebody else drive the data.
Yeah, that was exactly my question. Why mosunetuzumab didn't require hospitalization, teclistamab did. I mean, from our point of view, I don't know, there's maybe some good data to support it. It was kind of hard to figure out why, but.
Yeah, no, it is often hard to figure out. And, to be quite honest, the investigators don't get to sit at the table when those discussions are happening around, whether or not, in a clinical realm, we feel that people need to be or not. We may help inform the guidelines on the back end, but I'm not sure we're sitting there planning out the prescriber information.
So speaking of myeloma, I see iberdomide here being looked at with lymphoma. That's interesting.
Yeah, iberdomide got a name. I think it's going to make a name. It may not be in lymphoma. this trial is a fairly heavily pretreated patient population, you know, median of 4 lines of therapy. And, you know, it did, you know, you can see here the single agent was looked at in cohorts A at 2 different doses. And then you added a little bit of antibody, whether or not it was rituximab in cohort B or obinutuzumab in cohort C. But I'm just not necessarily seeing a clear path forward here, you know, unless you're adding something to it. Is this your kind of iberdomide IO, in second line follicular lymphoma? I just don't know the path forward here, at least with this CELMoD. I think the CELMoD class is interesting. Again, I guess I kind of said it. I'm not sure that's better than lenalidomide plus a monoclonal antibody.
I'm still waiting for one of those to get approved in myeloma. We've been hearing about it for years.
Yeah. So we're going to jump back to the middle of the road, which I saw as, mantle cell lymphoma, in my opinion, always has one leg straddling, both sides of the aggressive and indolent fence. You know, it can present indolently or it can present very aggressively, but I find it a very intriguing disease to talk about. And it was the talk of the town at ASH. It was in the Big Easy this year. I think everybody, sat in, maybe not everybody, but it was packed for the plenary session for what was abstract number 1, which was the Triangle trial, which came to us from the European Mantle Cell Lymphoma Network, the group that has brought us many large randomized mantle cell informing trials. And this was a 3-arm trial that was 1-to-1-to-1 and really had 2 experimental arms. So, kind of walking through this because I think it's worth the time because, you probably could have that oral could have been a 30-minute instead of I think it was 10 minutes, and it would have given Dr. Dreiling a little bit more time to kind of walk through the data because it was very complex. But it did allow for a significant amount of backroom discussions about really what are we going to do here with this data. So anyways, the control arm, R-CHOP alternating with R-DHAP, followed by an auto transplant, followed by observation. And one of the things that I think was very keen to note is that our maintenance therapy was integrated after the data showing their overall survival advantage after auto transplant. But the important thing was that the rituximab didn't appear to alter the arms because it was appeared to be given in a fairly equal percentage. And I believe in the forest plots, it didn't look like it affected each one of the arms, whether or not it was control or the 2 experimental arms. The second arm was giving ibrutinib with the R-CHOP arms, but not with R-DHAP arms, followed by an auto transplant, followed by 2 years of ibrutinib maintenance and then observation. And the second experimental arm was R-CHOP plus ibrutinib alternating with R-DHAP, and then 2 years of eye maintenance or ibrutinib maintenance followed by observation. So in that third experimental arm, getting rid of the transplant, right? And so this has been a question all along. There's a national trial in the U.S. trying to kind of look at this question too, but doing it based upon those who achieved the best of the best response, which was, your MRD negative via clonoSEQ, as well as PET negative, then randomizing that patient population. This is using a BTK inhibitor in the upfront setting, with maintenance and trying to pull away, that transplant. So let's look at the first, the top right curve here, which is really looking at keeping auto transplant, right? So arm A, versus adding ibrutinib to the auto transplant, which was here in the middle blue. And you can see here the green was statistically significant from a failure-free survival standpoint. So adding ibrutinib to the equation actually improved, but you had to keep the auto around. So then, you look at the bottom curve, and now you're asking the question, okay, now we're keeping the auto, but we're in the blue arm, which again is our control arm, But in the third or the bottom arm, you're just keeping the ibrutinib and getting rid of the auto transplant, right? And in that arm, you, and from a failure-free survival, you can see that it was better than keeping just the auto alone without ibrutinib. So where does this lead us? Well, it leads us down a path of, you know, if you are a cytarabine user or an intensive chemotherapy user of the R-CHOP, R-DHAP alternating regimen, you know, can you utilize ibrutinib with the R-CHOP arm and then forego the transplant and just give 2 years of eye maintenance? And is it worth getting rid of that transplant for the transplant-related side effects? So if I'm going to dip my toe in the water of this, where am I going to use it? Because, you know, if you look at the SHINE data, what held me back from adopting SHINE was the toxicity. So really, in my opinion, the devil of the details of the Triangle trial was how much toxicity did ibrutinib bring, not only during induction, but also in maintenance. And I think it looks acceptable in those younger, fit patients where you're trying to get the longest failure-free survival in the first-line setting, but you have to do it, you know, by using a BTK inhibitor. So you're using one of the tools in your tool set, you know, earlier on. But unlike SHINE, it's fixed duration, right? So you can put the BTK back on the shelf after 2 years. And if they relapse 6 years later, guess what's still probably there, or some combination of it to use again. So so I think that this will get slow if it gets on the guidelines, it gets approved. I think it will get slow adaptation, but it will get adaptation in a young, fit population.
So I don't have to tell you, this is the one paper I really wanted to ask you about. And also, I recall that actually at ASCO, we did a satellite, and you were the one who discussed SHINE at that point. Because to me, I look at SHINE and this thing together. So just a couple of maybe naive questions. So one thing I don't see here was the hazard rate on these curves. And my recollection was, like, the addition of ibrutinib had a better hazard rate. I mean, I don't even know if you can compare them, but compared to SHINE. I think SHINE was maybe about 0.75. Is that right?
Yeah. I think SHINE and Triangle, people are trying to put them on the same slide. And I can't because, you know, the backbone was different, right? BR. And the duration of ibrutinib was different. And here, you know, arguably on my intensity dial, BR is a 4, right? R-CHOP's a 5, and I give RDHAP like a 7, right? So you know, and it's a different population of a younger patient population, you know, less than 65, right? In Triangle. So, you know, I think there are several caveats that I'm coming around to, right? Like, I had to sit down and really talk to my colleagues about Triangle, right? Because inherently I'm a BR person. You know, I think BR gets people into a CR, and regardless if you're 55, 65, or 75 in mantle cell lymphoma. It's just, what am I going to do to each one of those age groups differently, right? 55 BR to a CR gets an auto transplant maintenance rituximab, you know, or I put them on the ECOG trial and let the randomization tell me, you know, what to do and really solve that equation and that data point. The 65-year-old, I think the data is starting to like, you know, do I do an auto transplant in that patient population, or do I just live for another day knowing that the BTK inhibitor is probably going to, you know, do good? And in that 75 population, I'm asking myself, if they get COVID during maintenance rituximab, you know, that could be a problem. So a lot more questions than answers coming out of Triangle, you know, but I'm coming around to the data, you know, with more time. I think that one of the things we need to continue to call out, which was called out in the in the SHINE data set is there are 0% TP53 mutated mantle cell lymphoma patients in if you never check for it. Right? There's 10%, 10 to 15% if you look for it. And I'm not sure you should be doing, you know, this data set or BR, you know, if the TP53 mutant patient population, I want to see, you know, that a little bit more in this, in the called out with longer follow-up in this data set.
So let me ask you a few naive questions here as I try to sort of figure, kind of begin to even understand this. You know, we're thinking about complex. I was just imagining, you know, getting RCHOP, RDHAP, and going into atrial fibrillation, but I guess that's another story. All right, so first basic question, do we have any randomized phase 3 data demonstrating a survival benefit of transplant in younger patients with mantle cell?
We have, their survival advantage was in the rituximab maintenance around auto transplant. Trying to think if there was a survival advantage in any of the other trials.
If you did a randomized trial, and I think there was like one that they started and wasn't able to complete, but if you did a randomized trial of BR and R maintenance versus, you know, arm A, so to speak, what would you see in terms of PFS and OS? What's your prediction?
My gut is that the patients who got into a CR likely could defer auto transplant if you gave our maintenance down the road. Why? Because the second and the third line therapies are so much better now in mantle cell lymphoma versus if you had done it 10 to 15 years ago. We didn't have BTK inhibitors. We weren't going to have, I think bispecifics will come into the market, and we didn't have CAR T cell. So to show an overall survival advantage in the current state is going to be incredibly hard in this disease, which, you know, if you look at the, you know, how mantle cell lymphoma has changed over time from a survival standpoint, you know, it's marching further and further out from an overall survival standpoint. And so I think, you know, maybe what you do in the front line, you know, yes, it matters, but I think we have more options, second, third, and fourth line to prolong the survival of the disease.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what I'm thinking too, because now, A, you have other BTK inhibitors might be, you know, safer than ibrutinib, yep. And you have CAR T. Maybe you're going to have bispecifics.
And you're probably going to have bispecifics. I think that's a, you know.
Right. So do you really need to start out with a transplant when you have, and if you could do a 20-year study, which of course, by the time you did it, you know, would be outdated. Do you think it really, there would be a benefit for transplant if you just did a good BTK, you know, second line and then CAR T third line? Do you really need a transplant?
Yeah, I think we're all asking ourselves that question. And, you know, my practice, you know, our practice should evolve with the data. Right. And my practice is evolving with the data. And I think that this is just data to help that evolution along, not unlike, you know, what potentially the ECOG trial may help us inform, you know, too, with regards to, you know, MRD assessment and PET, you know, kind of collaborating on whether or not, you know, transplant can get away from that standpoint. We can get away from transplant there also.
All right, please continue.
So, you know, kind of on the other end of the spectrum, when you talk about kind of R-CHOP, R-DHAP alternating regimens adding to it, you know, is the phase 2 trial of acalabrutinib plus lenalidomide plus rituximab or the ALR regimen. And I think that this was a very interesting trial because it also started to incorporate real-time monitoring of minimal residual disease. So using this as a MRD as a dichotomizer of in a disease where, you know, it's used to time-limited therapy. So you can see here small numbers, but great study, 24 patients. And these are curves that are kind of hard to find. You know, these are like Hodgkin's lymphoma curves here where you see nobody is appears to have progressed and everybody is alive with a median follow-up of 19 months. You know, and if you're MRD negative CR, you stopped at 24 months. And, you know, here's the other thing that I wanted to call out. Look at that. One or three out of 10 patients had a TP53 mutation. You know, so I'm always looking for other things to do with those patients. You know, classically, I've probably been considering ibrutinib, venetoclax off-label. You know, if I caught a TP53 early on and I can get access to it based upon some of the TAM data. But here, you know, this is also very attractive. So where does this go? I think it's impressive. It needs more patients. It needs, you know, broader, you know, people aren't afraid of lenalidomide. People are getting used to acalabrutinib and its early side effects to get patients through. I want to see the path forward for this regimen. But interesting data by Dr. Ruan from Cornell, and an interesting concept of how do you put the drugs back on the shelf to let them live another day. You let the disease define that. The next one is that I'm going to talk about is looking at Bruxucel, so autolusel in the ZUMA-2 trial. And so, again, I kind of alluded to when I was talking about the ALARA trial, you know, if you shut the lights off in my office and ask me to draw a curve on what a CAR T-cell duration of response curve was going to look like, it's going to be in those who have ongoing responders are going to have the who get into a CR are going to have the largest durability from that standpoint. But what I wanted to call out from this study is, you know, looking at what happens to them after they relapse, right? How many of those patients still were able to get therapy? But look at this, the smorgasbord of different therapies in mantle cell lymphoma. And I think what you're going to see here is, you know, a lot of these patients or almost all these patients had gotten a BTK inhibitor prior to going on the ZUMA-2 trial. It was a requirement. Not necessarily a requirement in the approved setting, but I wanted to allude here that here comes pirtobrutinib. So this is where pirtobrutinib is going to see the door is wide open in these post-CAR T-cell relapses. So remember kind of this data, because, you know, potentially this data could come back. It would be nice to know what you see what these relapse patients are doing post-CAR T. Pirtobrutinib, I think, has an acceptable AE profile, and it will get used in the post-CAR T-cell relapses. It may even get slotted ahead of CAR T-cell in the BTK covalent relapses. You know, be mindful in the data with pirtobrutinib in the Bruin trial, you know, those patients who are BTK naive did a little bit better, but the BTK exposed, you know, they did a little bit lower, but not dismal. But I really think the pirtobrutinib needs, if it's going to be started, you know, in my practice, at least early on, it's going to be as a bridge to cellular therapy. You know, I think that there's an opportunity with that drug also of, a brain to vein bridge. And then you get the CAR T cell and then a vein to gain maintenance, strategy. And I think that that's, you know, really where we're losing people in mantle cell lymphoma is on the way to CAR T. After BTK relapses, not always after CAR T cell. So we have to remember the real denominator, both in large cell lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, and less so probably in follicular lymphoma, is that, you know, intent to CAR is not CAR. And so the clock starts when you and the patient and the family say you're going to go to CAR T cell, not at time of apheresis, not at the time of infusion, but when you want to do commercial CAR. And we don't have that data. We need to really pull out the brain to vein time as an important time frame in cellular therapy. It is the true denominator of the success of cellular therapies, and it is unmeasured in clinical trials. And it's just it's a hard data to get in a multi-institutional fashion. But it's something that I think we need to pay attention to. Switching to glofitamab, we saw glofitamab data in the relapse refractory large cell lymphoma standpoint. Again, glofitamab has the obinutuzumab component to it here. It has a step up dosing. And this is, you know, data set from my colleague, Dr. Phillips, who looked at not only different step up dosing patterns, but also doubling the dose of obinutuzumab. You can see in the bottom cohort here with using 2,000 milligrams obinutuzumab lead-in and then followed by the step-up dosing. You see a lot of patients obtaining CRs with a lot of active follow-up. I think this is, again, you know, entertaining the question of when to use bispecifics. If they get a label in mantle cell lymphoma, is it before CAR? Is it after CAR? We have seen, you know, post-bispecific data after CAR in large cell lymphoma. I'd imagine, you know, we're going to see that more so coming to a coming to a future Congress near you, whether or not it's in person or hybrid. But I think it's going to drive this conversation of, and I want to be careful of the semantics, because when I left ASH, you know, I was very concerned that we were moving towards an environment of bispecifics or CAR T. And some of these diseases, I think that there's room to have the conversation of bispecifics and CAR T, or bispecifics and cellular therapy. Why are we making them adversaries when they could be, for the patient's sake, allies? And, you know, in my realm, I think that's where my mind is going. This is not an adversarial relationship. This is an alliance against, you know, against the disease. In all, you know, these are Marvel characters, you know, going up against, you know, in the end game against Thanos, in my opinion. Switching lastly to not to be forgotten, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and kind of moving into the, we spoke a little bit earlier about echelon one and how I think in the advanced stage now with the survival advantage, my practice has went to adopt a BV backbone with AVD in frontline advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so now, you know, what do you do in a BV exposed patient population? I've adopted the Pembro GVD data by Dr. Moskowitz from Memorial. That data was very impressive. And this is, you know, showing small patients around what was seen in the Moskowitz data set. I think hers was 32. You know, this was 35 patients with a median follow-up of 13 months. This gave a Nevo lead-in dose followed by Nevo ICE for two cycles. And you can see here the CR rate was 88% with a median follow-up of 13 months. You can see here a very good chance of surviving. What I caution is that we need to see more BV-exposed patients to kind of see where the checkpoint inhibitors or the checkpoint plus, you know, whether or not it's GVD or ICE. I've kind of deviated to Pembro GVD as my therapy of choice if I have a BV exposed patient. Why? Because GVD is an outpatient. And if I can keep patients out of the hospital and have a good odds of them going into a CR to get to a curative intent transplant, that's what I'm going to do. But I think that this, you know, also is another potential option with great data in Hodgkin's lymphoma. And then the last slide is bringing up camdelumab tesirine. So this is an antibody drug conjugate against CD25. And I think one of the tales of this drug thus far is not that it doesn't have activity in relapsed refractory classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's just kind of the unexpected baggage that can come with some of these therapies. And it's, you know, not very often do we see GBS or Guillain-Barré syndrome on the x-axis of many curves. In fact, I've never seen GBS on an x-axis of a curve, at least in the in lymphoma land here. And what this data set's trying to do is trying to carve out, you know, in a population that really needs help, you know, your relapsed refractory Hodgkin's lymphoma, and these are patients probably that have been BV exposed, that have been checkpoint inhibitor exposed, you know, that are really looking for probably some bridge, you know, and what it would arguably be a young population looking for a, you know, response to get them to an allo transplant, in my mind, you know, a therapy that has a potential to work. but you have to counter this finding of Guillain-Barré, you know, in the research studies as a path forward. And this is trying to look at, you know, is there something that could predict whether or not it's soluble CD25 levels, whether or not it was LDH level, or the interleukin-10 level. And really, I think what perhaps lower burden of disease as manifested by an LDH level may be something that they could glean out of the data. But I still think we're scratching our heads on you know, if this drug gets approved, you know, where is it going to be used in Hodgkin's lymphoma? And is it going to be, in my mind, in a young population, a therapy to try to get them into a CR to do something, you know, next? It's a window. Would be a window therapy, at least initially. And with that, that's all the abstracts that I brought today. I appreciate the attention. Happy to answer any questions or further dive any deeper into these abstracts, Dr. Love.
No, I really appreciate it. You did a great job. I'm really got a lot out of it. I just had two supplementary questions. You mentioned the term brain to vein, and I saw that in one of the papers you wrote, but I couldn't find the exact definition. I love the idea. What is it?
So, you know, the way I speak about the journey of cellular therapy of CAR T-cell is, you know, in clinical trials, you know, we focused on the vein to vein time. And I think, you know, a lot of the vein to vein time is fixed. So apheresis to infusion is the vein to vein time. The brain to vein time, in the way I speak about it, is me as the CAR T-cell therapist, the patient as the person that's going to receive CAR T-cell therapy, the family that's going to support the patient, right? The team that gets the financial approval to do the CAR T-cell therapy, both for the cost of the therapy and the cost of the hospitalization. You know, so the day that the clock starts, the day that you, the provider, the patient, the family, and the team moves forward to do CAR T-cell in the commercial environment. You know, so if that's prior authorization, single case agreement, you know, all of the things that the insurer, the third party payer, whether or not it's, you know, Medicare with a supplement, Medicare with a managed plan, or a third party payer, that time between wanting to do it and actually getting apheresis is the brain to vein time. And I would say that right now, the brain to vein time is the biggest issue in the benefit of cellular therapy in large B-cell lymphoma, arguably in mantle cell lymphoma, but it's hard to tease out that data, right? Why can a Medicare patient with a supplement go like that to CAR T-cell, but a patient that has a third-party payer or has Medicare with a managed plan waits weeks to get apheresed? And we haven't been able to dive into the outcomes of those different patient populations because it's very hard because it's institutional level data, right? And as the institution, you're looking at yourself in the mirror in this data set going, we're negotiating the single case agreement with the insurer, right? So we're part of this process. So the discussion can't be all at the insurer's space. It's also in the institutional realm. And that can make people very uncomfortable.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Lunning, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.